cooler countries.
I have two great privileges today. One is to introduce Professor Lechik Valcerovic, who's a man that doesn't need any introduction, so I'll be very brief with that. The second privilege I do have is to introduce here the closing lecture of the Mises Seminar, which is called the Franco Formula. And that's a very important, but in some way a very sad privilege. The opening or closing lecture, depending on the year of Mises Seminar, is called the Franco Formula lecture because Treasury officer of Mr. Goodwill, he died 4 years ago after a very painful and complicated start of cancer. Franco was a wonderful man, was a great engine behind IBM. He was not a big entrepreneur, a very small entrepreneur in a very interesting business. He was manufacturing machines for pharmaceuticals. He was a man that made available machinery to produce pills, not pills, machinery to make people. Franco was one of those people you typically associate with Italy in terms of its own entrepreneurial class. He was a nicely educated man. He graduated in economics and Turin under the guide of Cedric Gossa, IBM's first honorary president, and for something like 50 years, literally the only classical liberal Austrian economist in Italy. 50 million people, one classical liberal. That goes on. But also he was a very enterprising, intelligent man and went from being a middle manager of Fiat to be an entrepreneur on his own. He had a great disaster in his life, as many of us did. It was also a blessing from another point of view. That blessing and that problem was his wife, Marcella, who's a wonderful supporter of this seminar, and Marcella was responsible for the travel and the scholarship of which some of you benefited from. Those among you that are fully grantees are here. Thanks to Marcella. Marcella is a beautiful historian. She's a very important historian of thought, of Catholic thought. She's a great scholar of Augustine. She was a professor of Filippo Cavazzoni in the school, actually, at the university. But she's an intellectual, so one of the biggest problems in Franco's life was that at a certain point in time, he had a marvelous entrepreneurial opportunity, which was to become the monopolist for importing condoms in Italy in the late 70s. And he did not accept that because his wife thought it was somehow diminishing. So as many entrepreneurs do every day, he put culture, affection, love, his beliefs above the profit motives. And that's what people outside of this room typically do not understand. They think that entrepreneurs are just profit maximizers. They're not. As we all know from Armin Alchin and Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises indeed, entrepreneurs are human beings. They have feelings, ideas, sense of what's important in life, and sometimes they do prize these things above, purely prophecy. Franco was a very important man in the history of our history. In some way, our institute exists just because of Franco. He's the first man in charge of IBM finances was Carlo Lottieri, a wonderful man. He would have lasted a single day if Carlo wasn't in charge. time to got us out of scrambled eggs into being some kind of organization. And he was not a rich man, he was a passionate man. He cared a lot about liberty. And we are here, by and large, because of it. So we're very happy to be dedicating this closing lecture of IDEA to this memory. And it's a wonderful opportunity we do all have, because we're going to be listening to lecture about Zavalovich. Now, I could give you a summary of Professor Zavalovich resume. It will take me approximately 55 minutes just for the summary. He's an amazingly accomplished economist and decision maker. He's been Minister of Finance and Deputy Prime Minister of Poland. He's been governor of the Polish Central Bank. He wrote many important papers. He wrote a wonderful little book on lesson from post-communist transition that you actually find for free on the website of the Institute of Economic Affairs. And it's a very interesting read, because if you read it, you think you have a lot to learn from post-communist transition in countries like Italy that hope one day to be post-social democratic, but still we're not. We have been associated with Professor Balcerovich for a few years because he's been always so kind to this Leone as to be the man behind, one of the driving forces behind one of our regular seminars. Again, I can spend 45 minutes in telling you just a summary of his resume. You could very easily find on Wikipedia. But I think the most important thing about him, he was very clearly and very quickly realized as soon as I knew him before, is that he's a real man of ideas. And listening to him, you feel the privilege of listening to somebody who had extremely important responsibility in life, great success in something as difficult as a political life, and still is guided primarily by passion and beliefs in the importance of ideas. He is titled today as the institutional system, the policy shocks, and the economic growth, and I think there is actually no better way of closing this very interesting Mrs. Seminar than listening to Professor Balcerovich. Please join me in welcoming a very warm applause.
Start with four preliminary remarks. First, and obvious, economic growth is immensely important subject. It is the most important subject in economics. It is Adam Smith's subject. It is so important because huge differences in the long-term economic growth are hugely important for the standard of living, for the military position of a state, for the political position, etc. So it's a bit surprising that in mainstream economics, so much attention is paid to the demand side and so little to the supply side, even though long-term economic growth is based upon the supply side phenomenon. Second, in the mainstream technical literature, as you certainly know, what is called the growth theory of Robert Solow, used to technical contribution, does not consider institutions. Only the recent extension tried to link approximate factors like other factor productivity, capital, and employment to institutions. While we know that institutions matter. Third, even this extension focus on what I call systematic forces of growth. I will explain to that. And the attempts to explain the differences in economic growth exclude the role of growth breakdowns. So they are going beyond trade cycles, something deeper. This is not integrated. This is a separate subject, and crisis management is not linked to long-term economic growth. And so this would be the four marks, and this in this direction. Yes. So what I'm going to say is based on a book which I have co-authored and edited in Poland. It's now being translated into English and Russian. We just focus on empirical long-term trajectories of about 20 countries, and we have compared countries. Also. Okay. Now there are some illustrations. Then we look at Spain and Mexico. You see that in 1960 they were at the same per capita level, but they the rate of growth diverged, largely because of policy shocks. Mexico suffered three detrimental policy shocks in the 70s and the 80s, and they mattered in shaping the average rate of growth of this time. Yes. Ukraine versus Poland, as you can see, the starting point in 1989 was similar, and then a huge divergence. Less known factors, Australia versus New Zealand. Usually Australia, New Zealand is praised for the reforms, but Australia was has much earlier started the reforms. And if you investigate the growth trajectory, you see that part of the explanation why New Zealand diverged from Australia are, again, shocks. Now, there are more illustrations. They have led us, the team of workers, to distinguish two kinds of forces which we find useful in analyzing and explaining large differences in economic growth. The first one I call the systematic forces, in the sense that they operate all or most of the time, and they do their different intensities. And the second are factors which are responsible for large, deep growth breakdowns. And as you can see, both types of forces depends on the domestic institutional system or regime. Now, this is just a simple analytical scheme, a conceptual scheme. This is our variable, long-term economic growth, obviously depends on external shocks. Let us look at the domestic institutions. I found it useful to distinguish two kinds of institutions, which to some extent overlap. Now, property institutions should explain the strengths of the systematic forces. They can't do that. And they may be improved or deteriorated because of reforms. What is called Ordnungspolitik in German, institutional policy. Then fiscal monetary policy or direct interventions. They are maybe responsible for the policy shocks. And the extent of these shocks and their frequency depends on the institutional framework. We call it stabilizing institutions. And the first level is whether the government is limited. If it is not limited, then it's free to engage in whatever policies it has. It is largely disregarded in economic future, amazing economics, which regards the state or the government as a benevolent investment. Public choice has reintroduced the note of realism in analyzing the state. Now, so you may, and of course, you have here the political economy level. If you like to explain policies which in turn change institutions, you have to get much more speculative to some extent, but this is the deeper level. Okay. Now, my focus is on growth breakdowns, but let me mention something, say something about the systematic forces. Now, the first level conceptualization, as you know, is what? Employment, capital, and the total factor productivity. That's very useful. But I find it useful to distinguish between two kinds of growth mechanisms. The first one I call situation-specific and transitional, in the sense that they depend on the initial conditions, and they cannot last. They can operate for 10, 20 years, for 3 years, but they are not permanent, and they depend. For example, if your employment ratio is 60%, you can raise it to 75%, and in this process you get the acceleration. But then, it's exhausting. If you have a large bureaucracy, you can move part of these people to less destructive occupations, and to get the shift allocated efficiency is improved, but then it is exhausted. If some of your sectors has been repressed, like under communism, service sector was repressed because, according to Marx, it did not produce any value. Then once you are free of socialism, the repressed sector can grow at a very fast rate, but then they achieve the normal share. So this source is exhausted. There's only one source of growth which can be permanent and universal, and as we know, is innovations, which may be due to technology transfer and the spread of innovation is important. Because unless we prove that we reach the limit of knowledge, this sort will be permanent. And it is useful because when you look at reforms, that you should ask a question, are these reforms only releasing transitional growth mechanism, or are they also releasing innovations? And then the forecast will be different. Now, behind these growth forces are institutions, especially why innovations are blocked, why countries, why certain regimes were anti-innovative. I think there are two main reasons which then can be translated in more specific constellations. First, if the rate of investment is very low. Why? Because investment is needed in order to introduce some innovations. And investment is low, investment ratio is very low, the return from investment is still low or it is uncertain. And then we come to such factors as progressive taxation or corruption or the low protection of property rights, etc. So it's not a surprise that in Haiti, private investment is very low and economic growth is non-existent. But you may have a very high rate of investment and low innovativeness, and then with the passage of time, your rate of growth will decline. Why? This is the story of communist economies. Or, let's say, socialist economies. There was pretty high rate of investment, but declining rate of productivity. Why? Because of the lack of the market and market competition. But when I use the word competition, I'm not using this in the sense of perfect competition, but dynamic concept of competition. Surprisingly, prominent economists like Samuel Sobrak, Schumpeter, have overlooked the role of competition as a necessary factor for innovations. When you read Schumpeter's Socialist Capitalist Democracy, you can learn from him that under socialism, innovations are not a problem because the central planner can just order the managers of, say, on the private enterprise to introduce new technology, and that's it. He was in polemics with Mrs. And Hayek, and he took the side of socialism. Schumpeter, who is famous for his focus on innovations, he completely misunderstood what is the main driving force for innovations. Capitalistic competition. By the way, we know from empirical research that dynamic competition is absolutely necessary for high rate of innovativeness, but still we are lacking, I think, is adequate
theoretical explanation. This is at least a view of Edward Prescott in his recent books on innovations.
Okay, but as I said, I will focus on breakdowns, growth breakdowns. So that is, and let me stress that this is the work in progress. And I would like to point out to certain research areas which may be fruitful. So what would be the main factors which would be behind deep and persistent growth breakdowns? Well, first, working population, aging, if it is not compensated by other measures. Obviously, this is external shocks. This is quite obvious. Weakening of proprietary institutions, if you have accumulation of anti-competitive regulations,
then your property forces get weaker and weaker until you reach stagnation. I think that's the Italian case to some extent.
Flexibility of markets is very important for the diffusion of innovations. Because this is about mobility of labor across firms. Innovations matter when they are spread in the economy. But if there are barriers to the movement of people across applications and firms, you can only rely on a natural increase. And this slows down the diffusion of innovation. And finally, there are demand shocks, you have a positive demand shock, excessive growth of spending, and then as a result, you may get a negative demand shock. And I focus on the last category, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding here in the popular literature, and I think in the mainstream literature. What is the popular association of the world crisis? Capitalism, or free markets. If you say crisis, then the next word is capitalism. And free markets, this is to some extent in academic literature due to the fourth story that free markets are inherently unstable. This means not only they are fluctuating, which is obvious, but this is the story that once again they got down, they cannot on their own to get up. So a benevolent despot is needed. A Keynesian policymaker to get them out of the hole. And now we know that it is done before us. In the 19th century, it was falsified by reality. There were some downturns in the 19th century. State was much more limited. And you have found-shaped recoveries. So all these facts were neglected by this 20th century story. But second, I think it is ontological or, say, philosophically false. Why? Because who is blamed for this alleged inherent stability? What factors are blamed? Failings of normal people, animal spirits. What about animal spirits and about policymakers? They are free of animal spirits, they are perfect, they are angels. So in effect, the Keynesian story denies the uniformity of human nature. So in fact, it implies they have two categories of men. Normal is poor mortals and government people. Angels in Madison language. So these are believers in angels. Or an alternative explanation would be there are some mysterious mechanisms of selection whereby the best people from this mass are getting into the top. Obviously false. So I think this belief in the inherent instability of market development, let me repeat, is both false from the empirical point of view and is very suspect from the philosophical point of view. That is why we believe. Now, and this leads me to a very simple exercise. We are trying to link the extent of crisis, policy shocks, to the nature of the institutional regime, going beyond this capitalism who creates the crisis. And what I'm going to show is just illustrations, but I think one can make it more systematic.
And the what regime did you get the worst crisis, policy-induced crisis? Free markets? No, opposite regimes. This, socialism. When you have the total concentration of economic and political power, like under oriental despotism in the modern times. So no separation whatsoever. And what are the, under this kind of regime, there's a huge risk of catastrophic policies because there are no constraints upon the policymakers. And if it happens that you have some psychopaths at the top, it may happen from time to time, then you've got this. This is Mao. Yeah. This policy shows go beyond the economic consequences. This is genocide. Millions of people were killed as a consequence. Earlier, you have Stalin. Then Khmer Rouge. You have some minor shocks, but still very painful, like debt crisis in socialist economies before they collapse. In Poland, in Hungary, in Bulgaria, to some extent in quasi-socialist economies or status economies in Latin America. And this is overlooked in this popular talk and sophisticated talk on the crisis, on the origins of the crisis. Now, the second category of the regimes one can distinguish are quasi-socialism. Many Arab countries are quasi-socialist. And still are. In a sense, there is a dominance of the state sector, there is a wide amount of the private sector, but still the logic of the economy is socialist. And there's an illustration of fluctuation of policy shocks induced depending on the oil prices, which were not present in Norway, a bit more constrained government. This is not the final tool. These are illustrations, I hope. Chronic capitalism. The operational definition of chronic capitalism is that you have oligarchs, and that oligarchs is defined as a businessman who obtained his wealth and maintained his wealth because of political connections. So as a result, you have two classes of businessmen, politically connected and the others. Now this stratification, individual economy, this stratification is very bad for competition because this not connected majority compete with politically connected. And one problem of most of post-Soviet republics is that they make a transition, I think, from socialism, bankrupt socialism, to chronic capitalism. While in Central Europe, you don't have such a dose of chronic capitalism, in a sense that there is a separation between individual businessmen and the political powers, you have much more competition. But why chronic capitalism may make it for policy shocks? Well, this is a hypothesis because financial market may assume that chronic capitalists are protected by the political authorities and as a result they would offer cheaper credit. And they may fuel the boom. And these are illustrations of this hypothesis. So, the conclusion would be that it is not the free markets who are the main cause for painful growth breakdowns. It is an excessive concentration of political power. And you can illustrate that with even more proof by empirical evidence, so you will care more about concentration of political power than about free markets. And in the economies which are called capitalists, you could have some concentration of political power. I think without much, with not being very comfortable. There was a mention of the central banks. They are independent. What about accountability? Which does not violate independence. Regulators may be a petty despot. So you may have some entrance of any kind of political power. Now let me move to another topic, which is also hugely under-researched. What happens after a serious policy shocks. What about the longer-term economic growth? Most attention is dedicated to short-term economic growth, how to mitigate the crisis. What about the longer-term economic growth? And the striking fact is that you have huge differences in the longer-term economic growth after the growth breakdown. And so far, to my knowledge, there's a little literature on this very important subject. So I will present some illustration and some hypotheses about that. Now let me see that. There are some, of course, methodological issues. Very important how you define the pre-crisis growth. It has been cleaned up from the boom years. Otherwise, it would be exaggerated, average growth. But it can be solved. And you have three cases. The first one. The rate of growth is lower for a longer term after the crisis than before the crisis. The loss is not recuperated. Then it is not recuperated, but the rate of growth returns to the pre-crisis trend. These are illustrations. And the best category is that. So you may have a higher rate of growth. In this case, you may speak of creative destruction. So you have huge differentiation empirically. How to explain that? So since there is not much literature on that, to my knowledge, I will only add Edward Preston. You should look. The only research team who's been digging, to my knowledge, with this hugely important side of this Timothy Kino and Edward Preston. They are using more sophisticated methodology that come to the similar conclusions. So how would you explain, what sort of hypothesis can one put forward in order to explain huge differences in post-crisis, long-term economic growth? So, there are four possible explanations, logically speaking. First, it may be that factors which are independent of the crisis have produced higher growth before the crisis and slower growth after the crisis. So crisis is not a factor. For example, if there was a wave of technological inventions which accelerated the growth before the crisis, and it has been exhausted, and you have to wait for another wave. So this may differentiate the rate of growth. Now this will be like an accidental factor. Some people mentioned this in the comments. Another one, IT revolution in the 90s. This was the period, do you remember the name? Of great moderations. Great moderation, which ended, which moved fast. Then you may look for the explanations in the initial conditions. So what kind of initial conditions may explain, what differences in initial conditions may explain the differences in the post-crisis long-term of growth? Well, for this reason to mention, the debt overhang is huge. This depresses investment spending, consumer spending, and some people say that in this case we need debt reduction. The same goes for the private debt, in the sense that private if the leverage ratio is huge, it impacts the spending behavior. So in the sense you pay the price, if this is true, for the previous excesses. And I don't think there's any Keynesian policy which can solve this problem. Then, this is the Austin argument, which makes sense. And it's increasingly recognized that the boom years have their reflection in the output structure, capitals. So some sectors just grow too fast. And if you disregard this, the estimates of potential product will be exaggerated. with the negative consequences for monetary policy. Then what is your labor market regulations? This is very restrictive. So one very important and necessary mechanism of adaptation is paralyzed. And this is on these are examples. Then policies. Given that you have the same type of a crisis, differences in the policies may matter for the rocketing economic growth. What policies? To what extent policies include those which strengthen the systematic forces of growth, which are usually called the structural reforms, these policies? This is the first point. The second point is the crisis management problem. And this is something which has been mentioned in your literature. It's the mainstream crisis management, which consists in keeping very low interest rates, not for 1 year, not even for 2 years, but a couple of years, destructive. In the sense that it slows down the restructuring of the economy and the growth of the potential product. To my knowledge, this possibility is completely disregarded by the models, in the models used by the central bank. I have a very gifted younger colleague who is a member of Poland's Monetary Council, and he's writing on the book. He has found out 10 various channels through which persistently low interest rates lower long-term economic growth. Completely omitted from the mainstream literature on monetary policy. So what looks like a salvation may be a problem. Japan is one illustration. So you can find empirical work on Japan, which would suggest that in Japan, the fact that they have kept interest rates very low has slowed down restructuring of credit and as a result of the economy, and have biased the distribution of credit to the detriment of more productive material. First, and of course this is hugely important for the present time. Well, I would not even mention this arbitrary or discretionary fiscal stimulus, because it was pretty obvious from the very beginning that it cannot work. I remember I was in Washington, in my personal experience, when there was a lot of talk how only fiscal stimulus can jumpstart U.S. economy. By the way, the very word jumpstart conveys a certain message, a certain idea of the economy. You inject something, and then mechanically, it would start growing at a faster pace. But this mechanical analogy was false. Now, I am saying, because I just looked at the empirical literature about fiscal multipliers, including the one which was prepared by IMF. And in the light of this literature, it was rather obvious that it cannot work. It cannot speed up. And the proponents of this discussion of fiscal stimulus have a certain idea of a consumer as like Pavlov dogs. I use this Pavlov dogs. So you just do something and they react. They are not humans. They do not feel, they do not think about the future. They just mechanically react. So this is the concept of human nature, which is implicit in the Keynesian fiscal arbitrary stimulus. So this is, and finally, the underlying channel, the political channel, which influences what policies are used to deal with the crisis, is that we usually believe that crises are bad. But when they happen, they have one benefit. They may force the decision makers to introduce reforms. And in many cases it happens, but it is not universally true. You may find cases when crises have led to bad policies. Argentina, for example, after the state has collapsed, and they had a series of presidents, and then Kirchner was very elected, and they were very popular. Kirchner was very popular. Why? Because most people believe at the reason for the crisis and the previous market reforms. And as a result, they elected populists who engaged in populist policies. And they elected these populists, not the Argentinians, the distress that under Perón, these bad policies were overshadowed by the Chinese boom, the news boom. So terms of place had improved in Argentina, and many people had thought, look, non-conventional policy can work. No, they can't. So what matters is the interpretation, the popular interpretation of the reasons for the crisis. If the interpretation is such that people think, well, it was bad system, it was bad policy, we have to reform it, right in the Central Europe, that helps. But if people say it is because of the reforms that we suffer, then it is rather difficult to push through market reforms. And to some extent, this must believe depend on the sequence. In Argentina, which is just an illustration, there was a lot of genuine reforms in the 90s. There was a lot of privatization in the regulated economy. But the problem was that they had left intact some crucial weaknesses, which were the sources for fiscal irresponsibility and a very rigid labor market. So once more difficult times have come, these weaknesses have exploded the program. But since people heard that they have reformed, they have introduced lots of reforms, they blamed the reforms on the crisis and not so much the fact that the reforms were incomplete. And one of the lessons for the reformers, look at the crucial weaknesses and do not leave them intact. Because sooner or later, even if you do other reforms, look at labor market regulations. You may be very brave in other reforms, but if you leave crucial weakness, this would explode. You may explode your economy and may turn people against reforms in the false belief. So the final conclusion is that the battle of idea matters. Because here, look, how many interpretations of the present crisis we have. And the most popular are the most stupid. Yes, for example, take greed, very popular. What does it mean, greed? And most people guess they agree. What does it mean? Does it mean a feature of behavior, greedy behavior? If yes, then economists should explain greedy behavior. Why a greedy behavior has been more intense? This is a critical question. Or does it mean feature of character that more greedy people mysteriously come into the top position? So it should be explained, not assumed. Perhaps they assume there's a biological virus, virus, greed virus, which has been spread by enemies of capitalism. Undermined. Many people just to illustrate this that the most stupid explanations are the most popular. Many people say, assume like this, the financial crisis has exploded in the financial sector, which is true. But the financial crisis has occurred in the financial sector. Then they follow with the conclusion that the financial sector is the reason for the financial crisis. But this is a fallacy to conclude for sure. But the same fallacy says sneezing is your nose. But is your nose the reason for the sneezing? No. So the same fallacy. It's why, or third, especially in the Financial Times, they have devised a new kind of capitalism. They call it financial capitalism, and they think this is an explanation. So they confuse naming with explanation. But as I said, these stupid explanations are very popular. Because many people do not like me, do not like bankers or commit logical mistakes. So it is all the more important to try to get across with a proper explanation. And this is why I congratulate once again Bruno Leoni and Alberto for organizing this magnificent International of Liberals. You should copy the techniques of Bolsheviks in organization.